The Jewish holiday of Passover is tonight, a time for Jews to reflect on freedom from biblical slavery and the symbolic and real bondage that continues everywhere.
Whatever the slavery means for every individual person at any individual time to freedom.
For Ukrainian Jews, the message runs deep. Also today, a change in German immigration policies. In past generations, immigrants never really became German.
First 5 years, I think my grandparents never had interaction with Germans.
Now Germany wants immigrants to integrate into the cultural fabric. Plus, the T-Rex, not so scary with his mouth closed.
You wouldn't have been able to see his teeth. So it would have looked a little bit more like a lizard, or even something in the same vein as we look like with our mouths closed.
I'm Marco Werman. Lizard lips and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. In Jerusalem earlier today, dramatic scenes at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is from a video posted to social media after Israeli police stormed the mosque. They used tear gas and stun grenades against Muslim worshippers. Israeli police say people inside the mosque threw stones and firecrackers at them. The Al-Aqsa Mosque sits on top of an area that's sacred to both Jews and Muslims. The clash came during two holidays. It's the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and the Jewish holiday of Passover starts tonight. Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky is based in Jerusalem and following the news. Describe what happened this morning at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Noga. What provoked this?
It's really a tinderbox for all the reasons that you described. Plus, yesterday, the Jordanian government that is formally the caretaker of the Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem put out like a special request that there be no provocations at the mosque on the part of Muslims during this holy month. And so in response, some, you know, hotheads and a few members of the Hamas militia decided to stage a provocation and basically lock themselves up in the mosque, including some people who didn't really feel like being locked up with them. But the background to this is that there are really extremist Jews who also want to make provocations. Six people tried to take baby goats up to the Temple Mount today, Jews, to perform a sacrifice. And most difficult, the Israeli government has very, very serious extremists and provocateurs as part of it now, notably the Minister of Domestic Security. And he's made a lot of very inflammatory statements in recent weeks.
Before we go on, what is the goat sacrifice about?
Well, if you follow the Passover story, there's a traditional sacrifice of a goat that I think is probably apocryphal. But I would say very tiny minority of fundamentalist Jews try every year to take a goat up to the site of where the old temple was before the Roman invasion of Jerusalem and perform the sacrifice.
As for the raid, how many Israeli police are we talking about that went into the mosque? Dozens? Hundreds?
I don't have an exact figure for you. I think it was dozens, but it was, you know, it was harsh. I mean, especially you're supposed to take your shoes off before you enter a mosque. They came in with combat boots. The entire event seems to have been unnecessary in terms of security needs. Doesn't appear that there was immediate danger either to the police or to any citizens around. So the basic common wisdom here in Jerusalem is that, you know, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was considered basically a hate-filled rabble-rouser until he became the latest Minister for Interior Security, that he's really pushing the police that's under his command to act harshly towards what he views as Muslims acting out.
Well, the eyewitness videos that have been posted on social media are stunning and suggest a violent raid. Any injuries or casualties?
No casualties. I think there were some light injuries, and the videos do appear very dramatic. And I think we have to be careful because many of the videos posted on Twitter have been edited with a very specific aim of making it appear, you know, the Palestinian media has been reporting that Israel stormed the mosque, which is a bit of an exaggeration. But it's an unfortunate event, and it's exactly the type of event that 2 years ago set off basically 2 weeks of war between Israel and the Hamas militia that rules the Gaza Strip. So we're really on very delicate ground right now.
What reason is Israel giving for this raid?
The reason given by the Minister of Police, this Minister of Police has said that, you know, he was responding to Arabs basically who had fortified themselves inside the mosque. And the accusation made by Israel is that there were people being held against their will inside the mosque. My understanding from all of the professionals involved is that there was no immediate danger and that these are two sides really playing with fire right now.
And what responses have been coming from Palestinians to the raid and to this allegation that people were being held inside?
Well, there have been mixed responses to that allegation. I'm very cautious, as you can probably tell, about all of these claims, because in part what we're hearing from both sides is exaggerated emphasis being given to the actions of an extreme minority of people. It's all kind of representative of the tension that's in the air. The Palestinians, and more importantly, the entire Arab world is really very concerned. The Jordanians have called for there to be an emergency meeting of the Arab League. And the Israeli prime minister finds himself really between a rock and a hard place of his own making, because when he returned to power on December 29th, he announced that one of his top four aims, I'm quoting now, was to enlarge the circle of peace. And he wants to bring Saudi Arabia into the Abraham Accords with Israel. And the actions of his own ministers are causing the entire Arab world to turn away from Israel and all of the Middle Eastern Arab countries that have peace accords with Israel, like Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, have all expressed deep concern and are kind of gathering among themselves to discuss their future actions in Israel's absence.
You mentioned the Jordanian body that has oversight of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Who actually controls access to the mosque?
Like everything else, it's a complicated question. The body that runs the Muslim holy sites is called the Waqf. It's like the religious authority, like a nunciate for Catholics or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it is appointed by the Jordanian royal house and the Jordanian government. And the Jordanians legally and formally are the custodians of all the holy sites in Jerusalem. That said, de facto, Israeli police are the ones who kind of man all of the entrances to the esplanade of the mosques. They do so in general in a kind of very uneasy accord with representatives of the Waqf who are not armed. But you have that kind of tense cohabitation in the old city right now. Sometimes it works smoothly. I wouldn't say that this year is one of those times.
The incident today at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it happened during the holy month of Ramadan and the start of Passover tonight. There's talk that this adds to the tense atmosphere in Jerusalem. How?
For example, for Jews, the Passover festival is a moment of pilgrimage. So you have hundreds of thousands of observant Jews streaming into Jerusalem during the whole week of Passover to come and pray at the Western Wall. And it's considered a really important act for religious Jews. At the same time, it so happens that this year, unusually, Passover is taking place during the month of Ramadan. For Muslims, it's of supreme importance to be able to pray at the mosque during this holy month. And there are even certain nights during this month when you're commanded to spend the entire night kind of guarding the mosque, praying at the mosque. So these are moments of, I would say, high reverence, but also, like you said, intensity and tension. And having the police march into the mosque in the way that they did, whether it's justified or not, adds an enormous amount of tension and can really inflame, I would say, the passions, both violent and religious, on each side right now.
Reporter Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, as always. Thanks for your good questions.
And tensions are ratcheting up. Palestinian militants fired a barrage of rockets from Gaza into southern Israel. Israel returned fire with airstrikes of its own. Germany could see a significant change in the country's approach to immigration, making it easier for skilled workers to come to Germany, then stay in Germany and become German citizens. From Berlin, Rebecca Collard has our report.
It's not long after iftar, the breaking of the fast during Ramadan, and this cafe is buzzing. Patrons sip sweet tea and crack sunflower seeds between their teeth, spitting the shells into large metal bowls over the sound of Turkish pop music. The walls here are decorated with photos of Turkey, and it would be easy to imagine you were somewhere in a cafe in Istanbul, if it weren't for the mix of Turkish and German spoken by patrons like Omar Bayram.
Are you German?
I'm German as a citizen, though. As a citizen, but not really German. Not real German. Because if the society don't accept you as a German, you will never feel German.
Bayram was born here in Berlin. In fact,
my grandparents basically came as a workers' generation from Turkey.
In the decades after World War II, Germany was in a desperate situation. Millions of young German men were killed or maimed fighting for the Nazis. And Germany needed to rebuild. The country recruited millions of guest workers to fill the void. Bayram's grandparents came to work in a Siemens factory. More than 50 years later, he says his grandparents are still not German citizens and
they don't speak German at all.
Germany is now again desperate to recruit foreign workers because, like a lot of developed economies, its population isn't growing. Last week, Germany proposed new laws aimed at attracting 125,000 skilled workers from outside the EU every year. Interior Minister Nancy Faeser said the new laws would remove bureaucratic hurdles and make Germany a more attractive option. We will also enable well-integrated, well-qualified people to become German citizens, she added. These are people who will move our society and economy forward. Currently, Germany has some of the toughest and most bureaucratic immigration laws in Europe. Until the year 2000, even children born in Germany to immigrant parents didn't get citizenship. And after that, most immigrants still had to choose between their birth nationality and a new German passport. Today, around a quarter of Berlin's residents are not German nationals. The new bill will allow dual citizenship.
If you bring people to your country and say, okay, if you work here, you can vote in an election, you pay taxes and you do all the German stuff compared to my grandparents, you stay in your flat, you stay in your Turkish community.
Deniz Ait's family also came from Turkey. He says that experience is part of what motivated him to co-found Who Moves, a startup helping skilled tech workers move to Germany.
First 5 years, I think my grandparents never had interaction with Germans. Never, because they had a small village in Western Germany, only with Turks. You had like Turkish restaurants, Turkish shops.
Back then, Germany sold the guest worker program as a sort of development initiative. Workers would come to Germany, work here for a few years, learn new skills, and then bring money and expertise back to their home countries. But now Germany wants people to stay.
So you can see it as a bit of a rethinking of policies in decades past that really did not encourage or allow for the possibility of this more permanent integration.
Natalia Benalescu-Bogdan with the Migration Policy Institute is cautiously optimistic. Under the proposed new plan, newcomers that integrated and learned German quickly could become citizens in just 3 years.
There aren't just the technical aspects to hammer out, but also the symbolic aspects of who is German.
Back at the cafe, Omar Bayram agrees it's not just about laws.
I think it's a society mindset. I don't think that it's really about a piece of paper citizenship thing.
He says the proposed laws are a step in the right direction. But he says it won't be effective unless there is a change in the way Germans feel about people like him.
I actually went to German military when I was 18. And I still don't feel integrated here, because unless I don't have a German name and I won't look German, I won't be a full member German.
For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Berlin.
Coming up on the show, an effort in Canada to help LGBTQ people apply for asylum there. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For many members of the LGBTQ community facing persecution around the globe, seeking asylum in another country can be a path to safety. In Canada, a petition is now making the rounds that's calling to make the path to safety there easier. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Roxy Watts first remembers wanting to leave the U.S. and move to Canada back in 2020.
we still had Trump in the office, which was really scary for me.
Watts, who is queer and trans, had just started hormone replacement therapy, or HRT.
I was scared that my access to HRT would be restricted.
Her fear continued even when President Biden took office. The number of anti-LGBTQ bills has shot up in the U.S. in the last 5 years. The American Civil Liberties Union is currently tracking 451 across the country.
It's just gotten to the point where it's nearly unlivable for any trans person, regardless of what state they live in.
Some Canadians have taken notice. In January, Ontario resident Caitlin Glasson started a petition to allow trans and non-binary people to claim asylum in Canada due to safety concerns in their home countries. Glasson, who is trans herself, told local news she didn't know what kind of response it would get.
When I sent out my initial post explaining the petition and sending it around, I said, you know, if we're lucky, maybe we could get to 10,000. That'd be nice.
To date, more than 150,000 Canadians have signed it. The petition has gone viral on social media and even got a shout-out on stage at Canadian rock band July Talk's recent concert.
Trans and non-binary folks are being persecuted all over the world, and Canada has an opportunity to say, hey, come on home over here.
The petition specifically notes the U.S. and the U.K. as becoming increasingly hostile for trans and non-binary people. Rainbow Railroad is a global organization helping LGBTQ folks escape state-sponsored violence. Last year, 37 U.K. residents reached out to them for help, as did 223 people from the U.S. But more than 9,000 people reached out from other parts of the world, says Rainbow Railroad's Dane Bland. He's head of development.
The majority of our requests for help come from sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and the Northern Africa regions. But we also did see requests for help from places like Eastern Europe, South Central Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean.
Bland points out that the petition isn't asking for a significant shift from Canada's current protections.
Canada does accept LGBTQI plus people on the basis of their gender identity or sexual orientation. I think what the petition is looking for is the Canadian government to reaffirm its position and to prioritize the resettlement of LGBTQI plus people.
That's part of what Nikki Nastasia hopes the petition achieves, too. She's a drag performer in Ontario who has been closely watching the anti-LGBTQ bills in the U.S., like when Tennessee recently became the first state to ban public drag performances.
Obviously, our first thought as Canadians is like, oh my gosh, our neighbors to the south are going through this. This is going to end up coming here eventually.
Nastasia says the petition is an important way for Canadians to say they don't want to head in that direction.
If we're able to create Canada as a refuge for queer people, then that's kind of like making our stand that we won't let those like anti-drag and anti-trans bills and laws kind of come here.
Nastasia, Bland, and Watts all acknowledge Canada is not a utopia for the LGBTQ community, but it's safer than where many members live now. The petition is open for signatures until May 26. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
News now from the Jurassic World. New research suggests that Tyrannosaurus Rex, famously depicted as a toothy and ferocious predator on the big screen, not so toothy. The dinosaur likely had lips covering up those teeth. Thomas Cullen is co-author of that research. He's an assistant professor at the Department of Geosciences at Auburn University in Alabama. Thomas, when I think of a T-Rex, I have this image of big, sharp teeth, like a shark. What does your research suggest this dinosaur's mouth looked like, actually?
What our research suggests is that T-Rex or any other of its relatives had its mouth closed, you wouldn't have been able to see its teeth. So it would have looked a little bit more like a lizard or even something not quite like us, but in the same vein as we look like with our mouths closed, where you see sort of a tight sort of line of soft tissue connecting the upper and lower jaw. When it opened its mouth, you'd see all those sharp, scary teeth, no problem. It just probably didn't look like a crocodile. And that's how it's often been depicted in the past, is having its mouth closed and you can see the whole top row of teeth.
So more like a lizard grin, kind of.
Much more, yeah, exactly, like a lizard.
All we have today are T-Rex bones. How did you determine that T-Rex had lips?
So it's been a bit of an interesting problem, and people have gone back and forth on this for decades now. But what we did is We looked at a series of different types of evidence, and we were trying to think, what actual evidence can we see on the fossils that might tell us one way or another? And one of the primary lines of evidence for that comes from the teeth themselves from the animal. So when an animal has teeth in its mouth and they're covered by lips, they're kept in a moist environment, and that changes the properties of the enamel on their teeth, of that sort of outer layer. When the teeth are sticking out and exposed to air, the enamel dries out, and it's more likely to break down and crack and wear faster than it is if it's kept moist. This is something we observed in animals like alligator, that the enamel on the facing side of their teeth, they tended to wear down faster than the enamel on the same tooth that's facing the inside of the mouth, where it's being kept moist by the breath. In animals that have lips, you tend to see enamel that is similar thickness on the outside and the inside, because they're all kept consistently moist. And when we looked at the fine scale structures of the enamel on tyrannosaur tooth, we actually see that it looks more like an animal that has lips. The enamel thickness is the same on both sides, and it's not at all like a crocodile.
Wow. I mean, it makes sense, right? Any dentist will tell you saliva and a wet mouth are crucial to good oral health.
Yeah. And knowing that about these animals not only changes what we think about in terms of their appearance, but it also will impact that exact sort of thing. If someone's researching questions about the dental health and the dental development of animals like T-Rex or other theropod dinosaurs, they need to know if these animals were experiencing increased wear and tear on their teeth because they had their teeth sticking out of their mouth or not. That's sort of where this stuff kind of provides implications for, outside of the much more widespread impact of it, which is changing the way we think about the appearance of this animal.
Is your research suggesting that other dinosaurs had these lizard lips?
Yes, with some rare exceptions. I think the evidence now is suggesting that most of them would have had these sort of lizard type lips. Certainly among the group called the theropods, this is the group that T-Rex belongs to, and Velociraptor, and many of the bipedal, carnivorous, bird-like dinosaurs that we are used to seeing in movies. It's really just been in the big carnivorous ones where they're depicted with the teeth sticking out like this.
I'm curious, Thomas, what got you interested in this research around the teeth of T-Rex and its lips?
When we started looking at this, it was maybe 10 years ago when many of us that are on the paper were students, and it started out, I think, over just conversations in the lab, conversations over beers about the way that these sort of animals are depicted in media and in art. And then from that, we started thinking, for example, in specifically the lips issue, like, what actual evidence is there? Or like, is that really all that there really has been done on whether or not they had lips or not? And so we looked and found a few other things where people had made suggestions over the years. And then we started to build on that and designed a series of different ways of collecting data and testing things that we could do to actually try and get an answer at that.
Thomas Cullen is an assistant professor at the Department of Geosciences at Auburn University in Alabama. Thanks very much for being with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more news for you in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. A diplomatic flurry of shuttle diplomacy is happening, with China at the center of it. Talks of trade and war.
But the United States and China are not speaking.
Nothing face to face. Also ahead, remembering the creator of the board game Catan, Klaus Teuber dreamed up worlds of adventure and imagination enjoyed by families all across the globe. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tonight marks the beginning of Passover. Traditionally, Jewish families gather around the dinner table for the holiday with a festive meal. They eat unleavened bread, matzah, and read aloud from the Haggadah. The book tells the Passover story, guiding readers through the tale of slavery to redemption. Tonight, many Ukrainian Jews will be reading from a new translation of the Haggadah for the first time. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports.
This Ukrainian Haggadah is more than just a translation. There's a digital and audio component as well. The text is recited in the original Hebrew, and it's paired with material in Ukrainian.
Кідуш – це особливе благословення, котре розповідає про святість дня.
This project was initiated by a U.S.-based Jewish nonprofit called Project Kesher. Karen Grossman-Gershon is the CEO.
There has never been a Ukrainian language Haggadah before, to our knowledge. After the fall of the Soviet Union, most of the Haggadot that were created were in Russian, and increasingly that became a real problem for Ukrainian Jews.
After the invasion a year ago, many Ukrainians have turned away from the Russian language. This shift to Ukrainian is also happening in Ukraine's Jewish community.
We worked with a very wonderful team to not only translate the Haggadah into Ukrainian, but also to adapt it to this moment in history. And that's something that Haggadot have always done. They've always adapted.
Project Kesher's Haggadah, which is only available in digital for now, includes excerpts from Jewish Ukrainian authors and illustrations showing the reality of life in Ukraine today. One image shows a family sitting around their Passover table as a building burns in the background.
It's also Ukrainian because it really does look at what the Ukrainian people are going through right now. Whether it's in text or in the illustrations, you see the Ukrainian people going through this period of oppression that they've experienced under Russia and their fight, this existential fight for freedom.
The fight for freedom is an important part of Passover. Ileana Goltzman was born in Kyiv and immigrated to the U.S. in the late 80s. Today she lives in New York City.
We celebrate our path from the slavery, whatever the slavery means for every individual person at any individual time, to freedom. And this year, it is about Ukraine.
Goldsman has been volunteering with displaced Ukrainians. She traveled to Poland last year to help people who'd just fled the country.
At the moment, they needed our help. And as Ukrainian Jewish woman, I felt obligated to do all I could.
These days, Goldsman refers to herself as a Ukrainian Jew. That was not always the case.
A lot of people called me Ukrainian Jew, and I was always saying, no, I'm not Ukrainian anything. Please don't call me Ukrainian, because what I think about is how some Ukrainian people were not friendly to Jews, just to say the least.
Ukraine has a dark history of anti-Semitism, and many Ukrainian Jews choose to not associate with the country because of that. But Goldsman says that today Ukraine is moving in the right direction, evolving into a more democratic and free society.
With years, I started feeling proud of being Ukrainian Jew, and I am happy to say I'm Ukrainian Jew. It's actually a source of pride for me at this point.
Goldsman says she'll be using the new Ukrainian Haggadah, and so will many Jewish families who still live in Ukraine.
When the first time I've heard this news, I was like, wow, we really never had it in Ukrainian. Like, how come? How come we never had it?
That's Yelena Pisina. She lives in the city of Cherkasy in central Ukraine.
Having Ukrainian Haggadah is like bringing you back to the roots. And from another side, it's something that brings you to the future, that we have to start our own Ukrainian Jewish tradition.
Bringing the Ukrainian language to the Passover dinner table is part of that, Bisina says.
For me, the Passover is a symbol of the war, but not of the worst side of the war, but of the symbolism and meaning that we are fighting for our independence.
Bisina says she's noticed a fundamental shift across Ukrainian society. The war has changed people's sense of identity, and that goes for the Jewish community in Ukraine as well.
People became very united, no matter what religion you are, what race you are. I see how people are changing in Ukraine.
At the end of the Passover meal, there's a traditional prayer that mentions next year in Jerusalem. But a lot of Ukrainian Jews tonight, especially those who had to flee, will be thinking next year in Ukraine. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
European leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron, are in Beijing this week. Among other things, they're trying to push China to do more for peace in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, is coming to the U.S. China is not pleased about that. To figure out what all this shuttle diplomacy amounts to, we called up Robert Daly. He's the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and U.S. relations at the Wilson Center. Let's start with French President Emmanuel Macron, Robert. What does he hope to achieve in Beijing?
Macron is the latest of a number of European leaders to go to Beijing. The president of Spain, the chancellor of Germany have all been recently, and all of them are hoping that they can convince chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, to weigh in with Vladimir Putin and convince him somehow to stay his hand in Ukraine. So far, there has been no success along these lines, but Macron seems to think he may hold the magic.
Well, China is apparently ready to sign a deal with France to deepen links in aerospace and nuclear energy, agriculture, or supply chains. Is there any leverage here for France on Ukraine?
No, there is no leverage because China knows that France very much wants all of those deals. Macron is traveling not only with the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, who's been very critical of China recently, but he's also traveling with a lot of French CEOs, and they want to continue doing business with China despite what is happening in Ukraine. So it's hard to see where Macron's leverage lies. After all, he has gone to China. And in Chinese diplomatic tradition, that means that he is coming to the Middle Kingdom, if you will. If not to kiss the ring, at least he is coming as something of a supplicant. So I don't see any leverage for Macron here.
So how do you see Xi Jinping's relationship with Vladimir Putin? Is it solid? And if it is, what can be done, if anything, to peel Xi away from the Putin orbit?
Xi and Putin are in very strong agreement and in something close to an alliance, because neither of them wants to have their country's choices shaped by the United States. They see the United States as a twilight power that is clinging in a way that is dangerous and somewhat diluted to what remains of its hegemony. And they want to position themselves as a kind of entente that is an alternate source of rules, of global order. So that is a very strong partnership, and I don't think Macron can break it.
Right. I was going to ask. So in that sense, are Emmanuel Macron and Ursula von der Leyen basically proxies of the U.S. and with virtually no traction with Xi?
Well, they're not proxies. Macron, right along, has been keen to demonstrate that Europe can exercise what he calls strategic autonomy, that Europe, while it shares a lot of the United States' concerns about China, is a separate source of power that will march to its own tune. China has been encouraging this view. It would like to peel Europe away from the United States, restart talks with Europe on a comprehensive agreement on investment, which would strengthen financial relations between China and Europe.
So, Robert, another diplomatic mission, and here it's China watching closely. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, she's in the U.S. and California meeting with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. What do the two sides hope to accomplish?
Nancy Pelosi obviously went last August to Taiwan itself and said that the United States had a rock-solid commitment to Taiwan. Kevin McCarthy had said that if he became speaker, he would follow up and that he too would go to Taiwan. The Taiwanese asked him not to come. They didn't see that as being in Taiwan's interest because they knew that China would react strongly. And so this is their approach to having the meeting, welcoming the support of the U.S. House of Representatives, but trying to limit any damage that China might impose on Taiwan.
Is that possible? Because we saw China's reaction to then-House Speaker Pelosi going to Taiwan last summer. Not good, with China amping up military exercises around Taiwan, canceling cooperation channels with the U.S. Now with Tsai Ing-wen in the U.S., China's threatened to take what it calls countermeasures. What do you think that means?
Well, it will take countermeasures, and it's already launched some of its naval ships into the Taiwan Strait. And so this is a reminder of China's ability to impose a blockade or indeed to take Taiwanese islands. As Tsai Ing-wen is visiting the United States, her predecessor as president of Taiwan, a man named Ma Ying-jeou, who was the head of the Kuomintang Party, is in China on something of a goodwill tour. He's been there for 12 days with a number of young Taiwanese college students, and he is exploring possibilities for a less contentious relationship between Taiwan and China. And China wants to encourage this. So China is currently in something of a charm offensive against Taiwan because Ma Ying-jeou is there. There's an upcoming presidential election in 2024. China would very much like Ma Ying-jeou's Kuomintang to win. And so China may not want to respond too strongly to the Tsai Ing-wen visit because they'll antagonize the people of Taiwan, and they hope that more people in Taiwan will see it as in their interest to draw closer to China.
So Macron and Ursula von der Leyen coming from Europe to negotiate with Beijing, Tsai Ing-wen coming to the U.S. in part to counter Chinese power. What about this flurry of diplomatic trips interests you the most, Robert?
What interests me most about all of this diplomacy is that it doesn't involve direct talks between the United States and China. It is all happening outside of what is the preeminent great power rivalry, which is now happening on the grounds of something like a new Cold War. The Biden administration has been reaching out to China to try to schedule talks, but China has rebuffed the United States repeatedly. The United States and China are not speaking.
Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on U.S.-China relations at the Wilson Center. Thanks very much, Robert. Really good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
In Boston's Chinatown, the pandemic was especially tough on new immigrant children, not just academically, but also socially and emotionally. Yesterday, we brought you the story of a preschool addressing some of these issues. Today, we meet one family in Boston confronted with the developmental delays of their child and learn to advocate for his needs across language and cultural barriers. Reporter Heidi Shin has our story.
Sun Ying has been in the U.S. for 5 years now, but she still remembers the early days, she says through a translator. No, we're using the family's first names for privacy.
When I first came here, I didn't have friends. The language barrier and the weather is really dry and cold.
When the COVID pandemic hit, her husband lost his job as a restaurant cook. She was home in a small apartment, caring for two small children and her elderly parents, who feared going outside with anti-Asian violence on the rise. It was stressful. Then she noticed that her toddler Caden felt different. He didn't seem to communicate and move like other kids did. He wouldn't speak, and he kept banging his head against the wall.
It was really difficult for me, and every time I saw that behaviors, it was really heartbreaking. I don't know how to do that.
Caden's mom soon learned what it was: autism. The headbanging was an attempt to soothe his anxiety and his sensory overload. They were lucky to get an early diagnosis, because now doctors and therapists could support him. But it's been a complicated process lining up help: physical therapy, speech therapy, and support services at school. There was paperwork and wait lists of months to years because of the backlog that had built up with pandemic closings.
Perhaps because of the pandemic, a lot of the children in the system, you know, there's a lot of delay in processing school placements, and we got stuck for a while.
That's Grace Su, Director of Family Services at the Boston Chinatown Neighborhood Center, BCNC, where Caden went to preschool and his mom found support as a parent. It's a stressful and long process for anyone, let alone a recent immigrant family just settling into the U.S. And it's a time-sensitive one, since ages 0 to 5 are so crucial for brain development. It's much more helpful to get a child therapy at age 3 than it is later in life. But here's the thing. Her social worker at BCNC wouldn't fill out forms or make phone calls for Caden's mom, because that would take away her dignity and agency. Instead, they helped Sun Ying to advocate for herself by showing her what she's entitled to.
They come thinking that they're going to learn a lot from us, but at the beginning, we tell them that we're just here to share the tools with you.
They taught Caden's mom how to speak up when she's not being heard, when phone calls aren't being answered. They explained that she has the right to ask for an English translator, and they showed her how to make that ask. Caden has made progress thanks to therapy and support, and there's been one really big significant change with Sun Ying and her son.
In the past, he doesn't like his dad to standing next to him.
He wasn't very affectionate before. He'd push his parents away. But now, he loves to give hugs.
Do you remember the first time he came and gave you a hug?
I can't remember the exact date or time, but he just liked to hug me. That's the moment I remember.
As for her fears about getting attacked as an Asian American woman, those don't hold her back either.
Yes, in the past, I was really scared about everything. When I moved to this new country, I will get attacked by others. But right now, I think I will become more powerful or brave.
Still, she worries about the future, though. Her free time isn't spent on self-care. Instead, she's online, learning more about being a parent advocate.
I worry about how we can support him because we were getting older eventually. If we are not here, who can take care of him? That is the only thing I'm really concerned right now.
She knows her son's rights, what he's entitled to. And her biggest hope is that when he grows up, he can be independent too. For The World, I'm Heidi Shin in Boston.
This project was supported by the Dart Center on Journalism and Trauma at the Columbia Journalism School. This week, the Philippines identified four more of its military sites where U.S. troops will be allowed to rotate through, bringing the total number of shared bases to 9. It's all part of a defense agreement between the two countries. As Ashley Westerman reports from Manila, the move is widely seen as a deterrent to China, and not everyone in the Philippines is on board with it.
In February, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin made a stop in the Philippines to announce the next phase of the U.S.-Philippines military relationship.
And we're pleased to announce today that President Marcos has approved 4 new EDCA locations.
EDCA, or EDCA, stands for the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, a pact signed between the U.S. and the Philippines in 2014. The U.S. is not allowed to set up permanent military bases of its own in the country, so this agreement allows the rotation of troops through Philippine military sites. No new sites were added under former President Rodrigo Duterte, who chose to cozy up to Beijing rather than Washington. But this week, new locations were officially announced by President Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s office.
The 4 new sites are actually, 3 of them are in northern Luzon, and 1 is on the southern end of the island of Palawan.
That's military affairs expert Jay Batong Bacal. Some quick geography. Luzon is the Philippines' largest island that extends north towards Taiwan. Palawan is an elongated island that juts out to the west in the South China Sea. Batong Bacal says these new sites will add additional coverage to those parts of the country,
which would contribute to improving the ability to defend Philippine interests in these areas.
While neither the U.S. or Philippine officials have named China directly, analysts say the move is to deter Beijing from 2 things. 1, from taking action against self-governed Taiwan, and 2, from continuing to bully its neighbors in the South China Sea, which Beijing claims almost entirely for itself. But not everyone in the Philippines is on board with the U.S.'s expanded use of their military sites. Manuel Mamba is the governor of Cagayan Province, located at the northern tip of Luzon Island facing Taiwan, where 2 of the new sites are.
There will be foreign forces stationed at it, and foreign forces attract enemies.
Mamba says China is a neighbor, not an enemy, and that the sites are a roadblock to development. The province is rural, with a population of a little over 3.6 million people. Mamba says now his province won't be able to open a port they've been trying to reopen for decades because trade with China is not possible with U.S. troops in the province.
We have a lot of problems. We are poor. People don't even talk about EDCA in our province. They talk of fill their stomach every day.
Many Filipinos have decried the EDCA agreement as post-colonialism in action, going against all the reasons the Philippines expelled permanent U.S. troop presence in the early 1990s. There have also been ongoing issues with U.S. military servicemen and abuses of local women and the LGBTQ community. But just because it looks like the U.S. and the Philippines are military besties again, experts say it's not a given that things will stay this way. Jose Antonio Custodio is a military historian.
If you look back at the Duterte administration, we see that there were some tenuous moments when it seemed that the alliance would take a nosedive.
Former President Duterte not only openly favored Beijing over Washington, he also threatened to terminate the visiting forces agreement with the U.S. Custodio says to remember that Duterte's daughter, Sarah, is the current vice president.
To say the daughter wins in 2028, then there's going to be another period of hiccup again, you know, of instability and uncertainty with the alliance.
To be sure. Filipinos are concerned about China's growing influence, but they're also wary of U.S. troop presence in the country. Custodio says because the Philippines will likely always need the U.S., Manila should work harder to develop a mature military relationship that works for everyone. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
Family game nights owe much to a former dental technician named Klaus Teuber. The German inventor of the game, The Settlers of Catan, died on April 1st. Here's Teuber in a promotional video from 2021.
Catan was the story of the Vikings when they explored the ocean, not only sailing on the coast, but they discovered Iceland.
As you can hear, Teuber was a student of history and literature. He said Catan and all of his games were inspired by stories.
It's a little bit of discovering new worlds, yeah? And each game is a kind of a world.
And what a world Catan is. You arrive on an island and first task, build a settlement out of just the raw materials you can find.
There are multiple reasons that the game is as popular as it is.
Alex Yeager is a game designer. He began playing Catan after it came out in the late 1990s.
You always had something to do. In so many games, you take a turn and then you wait for it to come back around to your turn again. Because of the trading in Catan, suddenly you had this activity that you were doing on everybody else's turn.
For example, you might need to trade the rocks from your quarry for, say, a source of food. Or you might have too many sheep, but not enough lumber.
All right, cut it down!
Those game sounds from Sirenscape are often used by Catan players. Also, the look and feel of the game from the beginning, that was part of Teuber's genius. Here's game designer Alex Yeager again.
So Klaus Teuber was a dental technician, but what that meant was he had this really amazing fine motor control. So his prototypes were always these amazing shapes that he would sculpt.
Yeager, who knew Teuber, credits him with changing how board games are played.
So as a designer, he was this wonderful example of how to create something that could be unique and different and have things that people have never seen before in a game, but also to present it in such a way that you could easily understand, play it, and enjoy it.
The Settlers of Catan was Teuber's biggest success, but he and his sons went on to develop other games that also earned high marks from the gaming industry.
He always had his family with him. You know, his sons are very much part of that business, that, you know, they have grown that business alongside of him, so it's always been a family affair.
Teuber's family noted his passing in a post online yesterday. It said, in part, "We encourage you to honor Klaus's memory by being kind to one another, pursuing your creative passions fearlessly, and enjoying a game with your loved ones." Klaus Teuber, age 70, creator of games, creator of worlds, remembered today for his most famous creation, The Settlers of Catan. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego, online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.